Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's No Fun by the Stooges. The Stooges made their first live album on this day in 1967. And last weekend, I moderated a panel at the Everyman Theater here in Baltimore, part of our World of the Play series, called A New Top Gun, A New War. In this conversation, inspired by Everyman's current performance of Grounded, we interrogated the topical themes surrounding women in the military, motherhood, and the ethics of drone warfare. We were joined by three women in the military, two of whom were combat veterans who flew combat missions in jets, and one person who joined us as well who was an ethicist. Welcome, everybody. Good to have you here. This is going to be a fascinating conversation. I don't know how many people have seen this play yet. Almost everybody. Okay, many of you have. So let me just begin by describing this. I interviewed the playwright last week, and we aired that interview. In this play, Grounded, by George Brandt, I watched it the other night, and just to go over it just for a second, it's about a woman who is a pilot who has been grounded from flying her fighter plane because she's pregnant. And then she is forced to become a drone pilot. And the play is about her angst of being grounded and about her the emotional and ethical foray she goes into around issues of flying drones. And it's a very powerful piece. And as we were talking about earlier, Norma was saying that it's also interesting the play is written by a man, directed by a man, and written by a man who's never been in the military. So that also, we have to take that into account as we think about what the play says. So we have this incredible panel. I would say Norma worked her tail off to put this panel together. This is a really impressive panel. So let me introduce folks that are here. So at the very end of the panel is Colonel Maron McAvoy. Colonel McAvoy is Vice Commander of the 113th Wing, District of Columbia Air National Guard, the first female Vice Commander and first non-rated Vice Commander, which we'll talk about in a minute, of the 113th Wing. And so she basically runs that wing. And in that wing is next to me, Major Heather Penny, who is participated in a number of combat missions already, Operation Noble Eagle, Operation Iraqi Freedom. On September 11th, she was one of the first pilots to scramble to the air to defend the Capitol after the attacks on this country. She retired, but she's now in the Air National Guard in the 201st Airlift Squadron. And with us is Lieutenant Commander Alex Dietrich, who is next to Major Penny. And she is a F-18 strike fighter pilot from the FEA 41 Black Aces in Lenoir, California. She's logged over 1,250 hours and 375 carrier arrested landings. And if you ever know anything about the military and landing planes, landing a plane on an aircraft carrier and taking off again is a feat into itself and a skill into itself. She is now grounded, so to speak, because she's pregnant, and which fits into some ways what we're looking at. And we also have with us Dr. Fahim Yunus, who's been a guest on my show numerous times. He's senior fellow of the Hofburger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. He's a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Maryland, and is an ethicist and wrestles with these questions about drones and warfare. He's from Pakistan, and he's a leader of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, which is a Muslim community in Pakistan, but across the globe, that has been persecuted by other more stringent elements in the Muslim community. And he's opened this dialogue here in America and around the world. So that's our panel. Welcome. Good to have you with us. I feel like I took up the whole hour already. No. But let me begin by talk to Colonel McAvoy first, just because I know you saw the play, and I know the other panelists have read the play. I'm curious whether you read it or saw it, how this play felt to you. How real did it feel? How much of her wrestling was the kind of wrestling you think you or others around you might have gone through? I mean, how real was it?
I'm still a little emotional about it, actually. It really hit home to me, and the whole time I was watching it, my first thought was, how could she memorize for an hour and a half this? But then she transported me even more. I just got lost in the character and the story of the play. And as a commander, the one thing I noticed about her on stage was she was going through PTSD. And I didn't really think that was addressed, but I think that's what she was dealing with when she was killing people with the drone. But it was a very powerful play, and I really enjoyed it.
That's an important point I was going to bring up later, because I felt the same thing, that the PTSD was very real in terms of what she was feeling and seeing at the moment. How did it feel to you?
So I did. I saw the 2 o'clock show today.
You did see it. Okay, good, good.
And so as you said, it was written by a man who has not been in the military. So it was emotionally powerful, definitely. But I saw a lot of technical details that I would have liked to have.
Yeah, like what?
Sort of hit pause and say, actually.
Like what?
That's not how we do it.
I'm curious. Like what?
Well, most notably would be the PID and the BDA criteria that we have. So positive identification of targets and the battle damage assessment. So it was, it was almost as if the playwright was saying, well, we just sort of on the spot make this determination of whether or not to drop, right, this guilty determination, and that's not really how it's done. So we were much more almost surgical in our mission planning, our target identification, and then our decision to actually deploy ordnance. And then this idea of lingering, and sort of mourning or the shock of body parts or this death and destruction. We actually have a BDA assessment, battle damage assessment criteria that we have. So we have to stay with our sensors in the target area to collect this information to then take it back. So there's some technical details that I, didn't quite sit well with me. Just and wanted to share that to let people know that we are much more systematic.
Heather. Alex, I'm glad you brought that up because that is actually a really important point. And I understand that that's a necessary conceit that the author needed to be able to do in order to be able to bring the psychological climax of the drama to a peak. But as Alex said, it is really much more deliberate and far more considered whether or not it's a remotely piloted aircraft, which is what we actually call drones in the services. So whether or not it's actually a remotely piloted aircraft or if there's actually a fighter pilot above the target, it is far more considered and deliberate, and especially the collateral damage considerations as well. Collateral damage often will cause us and trigger us to pass up an opportunity to strike because we are so unwilling to accept collateral damage. So I think that those are very important technical considerations that, this is when you peek behind the real world, it is much more deliberate than how the play portrays that. On the other hand, one thing that I found that was really resonated with me when I read through the script was how difficult it was for the character to deal with leaving her fighter. For me, that emotionally resonated very strongly. I've had 2 daughters, two girls while I was operational. And had to requalify in the jet both times. And then ultimately, as a single mother, I was unable to be able to balance both of my worlds. And so I made the difficult decision to step out of the aircraft before my level of proficiency because of the demands of both of those responsibilities. I needed to make the right decision and leave before I was told to leave, if that makes sense. So coming to a point within my career where I recognized that I needed to leave the F-16 was an incredibly torturous decision. It was very, very hard, and it's something that I still mourn today. I know that I made the right decision because when I look at my daughters, there's no doubt in my mind. And as any fighter pilot knows, unless you're the best fighter pilot in the room unless you're always the best fighter pilot in the room, then you have no business being a fighter pilot. So I know that I also made the right decision there. That doesn't mean that it's not a decision that even today still lingers.
That kind of leads into something I'm really interested in for the three of you, especially before we turn to Fahim, which is we talked before we started this conversation that I said it's relatively new that women have been in the positions you're in, and I think you, Heather, said, well, it's been 20 years. But even that's relatively new in some ways, was my response to that. That, and also, it's still a very male-dominated world, the military. And you are three women who are three mothers who are dedicated to the world you're in. I'd like to explore that for a minute. I mean, you know, I mean, because we don't, we still, I think, in America, do not think of women as fighter pilots. Women in the military in combat. I mean, my era, the 60s, that wasn't real. Never happened, right? But it's real. It's a piece of it now. And I'm curious what about you, the three of you, and what pushed you into it, not pushed, but what brought you into it, but how you think being a woman and women have changed the nature of service in the military. Why don't you start, Commander?
Everybody looks at me. One of my favorite quotes is, I don't fight the female fight, I just do the best job that I can. And I don't know who to attribute that to, but I've always had it on a sticker above my computer. I'm not a mother, but I almost feel like it's been a product of my career choice. In fact, even a couple years ago, when I was about Alex's age, 36, I was thinking, you know, I don't have a child yet, but I think I was a lieutenant colonel at the time, and I thought, I could go get pregnant right now. I could go to a clinic. I could go to a bar. I could get pregnant right now if I really wanted a child, but the logical part of me said, I will never get promoted if I'm walking around the halls of this unit as an unwed pregnant mother. And the years just kept slipping by. So now I'm a pet parent, but it's just it's a product of the career choice that I made, unfortunately. And I don't think I would have been here where I am today had I had children.
Alex. Well, I'd just like to say that the legacy is much longer than that. It dates back to World War II and the Women Air Force Service Pilots. So the WASPs definitely lay the groundwork for that. And for that, I'm grateful, right? Because we definitely stand on the shoulders of giants. When I entered the military, I was going into ROTC, and there's a couple ROTC midshipmen in the audience I just want to give a shout-out to. It was pre-9/11. It was 1997. I have a lot of respect for those who sign up and join now when we have conflict on so many fronts, and they're going in eyes wide open. But when I joined, it was peacetime, and it was selfish motivation. I wanted to get an education, debt-free. So an ROTC scholarship is full tuition. And I wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world. And I wanted to fly. So Top Gun had come out a few years earlier, but it was still, you know, I didn't necessarily have a crush on Tom Cruise, but I really had a crush on his jet. And I thought that looked cool. I thought that looked, you know, my guidance counselors in high school were saying, what are you going to do? You have to make a decision. Do you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer? You know, we've got to get you into a college and get you on track. And I thought about all the doctors and lawyers and engineers I knew. They were 40-something. Some of them were divorced or on their second career, you know, midlife crisis. And I said, well, why not get my midlife crisis out of the way first and go do this cool thing? I commissioned in May of 2001, headed down to flight school. Actually, my first flight on September 11th. And so that, as you can imagine, was a real paradigm shift for me and my peers who had signed up at the same time. And we realized, you know, we're part of something much bigger than ourselves. And I got my wings in March of 2003. If you remember, that's when we were making the big move into Iraq. So you know, throughout I definitely had a coming of age and in more than one way as that went through. But I was still self-centered in that I wasn't thinking about a family. I wasn't thinking about kids. And it was pretty late in my lieutenant years that I looked around and I said, okay, I've sort of been there, done that, checked the block. I've had this great experience. I've traveled the world. What next? And you know, then the clock started ticking, and that's when I realized it was time to settle down.
Heather.
Well, when I am asked the question about women and fighters, women in combat, my response is the jet doesn't care whether or not you're a man or woman. It just cares how well you fly your jet. Do you know your tactics? Are you a good stick? What's your competency level there? But that's the jet. And being a woman in a fighter squadron is a very different deal, because the guys do care whether or not you're a man or a woman. And being the only female fighter pilot and the first female fighter pilot in a combat fighter squadron was not an easy transition for either of us, let me just say. It was a difficult transition for me to learn how to engage within the culture of the squadron. And it was, frankly, a difficult transition for the fighter squadron as well, because it's not a secret that the fighter pilot culture is very masculinized. And we're still dealing with how to professionalize the warfighter culture today. Because when you think about it and you really take into consideration what is necessary to be a proficient operator, whether or not you're a fighter pilot or a cyber operator, or whether or not you're in space or you're doing tactical airlift or you're in special operations, war is very much an art. Yes, we have tactics, and those tactics are very much based off of testing, and there's a tremendous, you'd be surprised, math. There's a tremendous amount of math that goes into that, as well as engineering, the mechanical engineering of the weapons, and it is highly intellectual. It is chess at 500 knots and 9 Gs. But it's still an art. And so when you enter into a fighter squadron as a young lieutenant, yearning to learn your craft, you're an apprentice. And you require the investment of the instructor pilots above and around you to nurture you, to invest in you, to teach you. And if you're an outsider, if you're not part of the club, and you don't adhere to the cultural norms, you risk the quality and the depth of that level of investment. So if you're not in the organization culturally, you might not reach the potential that you could if you're an outsider. So there's no way for a woman to be part of the boys' club. It just doesn't happen. It's not possible to outboy the boys. And unfortunately, in some of the young chicks, because we now, thanks to the wonders of social media, have an organization, the Chick Fighter Pilot Association. And it's actually a wonderful way for women to reach out, because we are oftentimes geographically dispersed. For some reason, and I'm not sure if it's because we get treated a little bit like dodgeball. So if there's a number of women in a fighter wing, oftentimes one woman will go to one fighter squadron, they'll send another woman to the other fighter squadron, and they'll send the other woman to the other fighter squadron. So we're all separated. I'm not sure if it's because they think that there's strength in numbers, and if we get together, we'll gang up. That's a joke. In actuality, you know, it's unfortunate, because what it does is it deprives those women of the support that they could have, because what we face as female warfighters, we have different considerations, different concerns, and different stresses that the men do. And it's not to say that there's not good eggs in the fighter squadron. There are tons of wonderful men who are there. And there are strong relationships that we've forged with. When you go to combat, you can't help but to forge strong relationships, because you depend on each other. Your lives literally depend on each other. And that creates a strong emotional relational bond that cannot be denied. But it's still not the same. And I've seen in some of our young chicks the effort to comply with this masculinized culture. They're trying to outguy the guys. And the challenge that can impose is that it disrupts your internal moral compass. Not that you're necessarily making right or wrong decisions on an ethical scale that I'm sure we'll be discussing later, but really in terms of understanding where your healthy boundaries are, understanding really kind of who you are in terms of your identity. Because if you ask anyone, any one of us, or you walk into a fighter squadron, the response from those pilots are not going to be, "I fly fighter jets." The response is going to be, "I am a fighter pilot." It's very much an issue of identity that we internalize and we're proud of, because we work so hard at our craft and we work so hard to fulfill the responsibilities and the privileges that the United States depends and relies on us to be able to do. And so it is a very different thing to be a woman in a fighter squadron. The jet might not care, but it, in terms of negotiating the human landscape, it's different.
So before we turn to Fahim, I want him to talk about why the play affected him so deeply and how this fits into the conversation about lies in the military. One of the things we also talked about, I think that it's important we're out here, is that I think it was said, I forget who was saying it, whether you said it in the back or you, that women do affect the nature of the military and are changing it over the course of time because women approach life many ways differently than men do. And that I think you're the one, Heather, might have said this, that a lot of the millennials coming in, people born in their 80s who are now in the service, see male-female roles very differently and think in some ways more femininely, for a word I just made up, than other generations. So, I mean, do you see, I mean, I wonder if Maren, you see that as commander, if you see those of a unit.
If the younger group coming in is more touchy-feely?
Well, no, and whether women in general are changing the nature of the military, changing the culture.
There's so many different organisms in a military unit. I can't really be a generalist about that. The fighter pilot, you know, the fighter squadron is so different from the other side of base where you are in services and there's more females in there. You really can't generalize that. I think women bring that extra analysis to things where, this is just my personal opinion, men make fast decisions right on the spot. And I do this with my current boss all the time. He's a one star and he is the commander of the fighter wing and I'm his vice. And every day we talk about something and I learn from him, but I think I bring the feminine side to it and I have different things I see that he's like, I didn't think about it that way. And meanwhile, I'm watching his brain work, and it's black and white. You know, we're going to do A, B, and C. And I'll come back with, well, there's D, E, and F that could affect A. And we go back and forth with this all the time. So I do think it's a product of the way women think and how we can multitask. I do think there's a different difference. Absolutely.
Can I jump in here?
Absolutely.
So what you're just talking about, Maren, is if you look at, there's not a lot of research done right now on the presence of women and their impact within the senior leadership of the military. But if you make the analogy between women at the board level, so at the C room, right? So at the corporate board director level of Fortune 500 companies, whether or not it's Carnegie Mellon, and I'm forgetting some of the other groups that have done studies. But the presence of women on those Fortune 500 companies at the C board level actually is directly related to their increase of return on investment, return on sales, and return on equity. So having women at the senior leadership level actually improves the outcomes, performance outcomes of their organizations. And then if you take this down to a smaller level, the presence of women also increases group collective intelligence. And in this case, 30% actually happens to be the magic number. So in groups of 10, if you have three female members in those groups and they're given complex problem sets, the collective intelligence of the group and their ability to solve those problem sets rises dramatically above the highest IQ single member of that group. And having less than three members, so less than 30%, actually brings the performance of the group down dramatically below the level of the highest IQ of the member of that group. So having this diversity, and specifically the presence of women at the senior leadership level, is incredibly important towards the performance outcomes and the decision-making skills of those groups. So at the senior leader level, that's incredibly important.
Alex?
So to answer your question as to whether the younger generation are becoming, I think, more sensitive might be the right word. I'm looking at the midshipmen here who have driven up from Washington, D.C. on their own accord. Nobody's made you come up here, right? And how old are you?
21.
21, 20, 22 on a Saturday night. And Joe, I just want to point out, Joe was pursuing the Navy SEALs, right? Spec Ops. So here's the guy who's, you know, pursuing a community, a warfare community that isn't even open to women, and he chooses to spend a Saturday night coming up to watch, you know, a one-woman show on a chick fighter pilot. This is the generation. And so you alluded to these social networks that we have now. Mm-hmm. When I was a midshipman, I mean, I didn't even know the questions to ask, let alone who to ask them of. And so the questions that these kids ask, I mean, it amazes me. Every day I get these emails out of the blue. They find me on the internet, or they find me online, or they hunt me down on campus, and they say, you know, tell me about everything, you know, and they have a list of 50 questions, and they go through them systematically. And so it's, I wouldn't say it in a negative, or, you know, they're becoming more feminine or more sensitive in a bad way. I think it's great. I think that they're asking the right questions. They're definitely critical thinkers. And this idea of women in these positions is becoming more and more normalized, which is why when somebody asked me if I wanted to come sit on this panel, I always say yes, whether it's talking to school groups or going to Air and Space or anything where I can just say, yes, I'm a female pilot. I am a fighter pilot, and to make it more normal for the public and especially for the younger generation, so that, you know, it's a possibility for them and not such an anomaly or a novelty.
So let me find him. You've been very quiet, but let me bring you in. Tough crowd to get into word. I know that's true.
Hold on. I got to tell a joke, right? So,
go ahead.
You know, there's how do you know if a fighter pilot walks into a room? Don't
They'll
worry.
They'll tell you.
They'll let you know. You know, and my other favorite is when a fighter pilot goes on a date. Well, enough about me. Let's talk about flying.
So, I'm curious. What's the percentage of women who are fighter pilots in the Navy and Air Force?
I'm sorry?
In terms of men, in ratio to men.
Goodness, I don't even know, but I think the last count for the Air Force, we had between roughly 3,500 fighter pilots, and of that, less than 100 are women, and that includes weapon system operators, so WISO sitting in the backseat.
Navy?
Numbers are very similar. Of the entire Navy, only 14% are female, so, you know, go down from there as far as what billets they're at. We have a lot of, obviously, support billets, medical, nurses, right. Things like that, but
that's what we're talking about.
The current operational fighter pilots, I can probably count on my fingers and toes because we're all friends. So
that says a lot.
You're listening to the World of the Play panel discussion I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater in conjunction with their performance of Grounded. We're talking about women in the military, motherhood, and the ethics of drone warfare. We'll be right back. On our way to break, we hang Johnny Get Your Gun by Tom Paxton. Tom Paxton, born on this day in 1937.
Johnny got a gun, he didn't bring it home. He covered it rags and dirt. On his way to school, he looked both ways, then he hid it under his shirt.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Eugene's Lament by the Beastie Boys. Adam Horovitz of the Beastie Boys, born this day in 1966. Now let's get right back to the World of the Play panel discussion that I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater in conjunction with their performance of Grounded. This conversation was called A New Top Gun, A New War. Two of our panelists are Top Guns, women, jet pilots.
So let me, Fahim, I'm going to ask you, when you watch this play, as we said earlier about, we know what the play's about. You said the last 15 minutes struck you more than any others. So I want to hear and why you say that. And as you were saying that, Maren was kind of shaking her head. Yes, so we'll probably go to Maren after that. But why the last 15 minutes? What hit you? And I'm speaking to you now as both as an ethicist who's argued and wrestled with the question of drones and war and the rest.
If you allow me, I'll just take a second to come to that. But for the first 43 years of my life, I didn't understand something that I understood in the past 3 hours today. Since I watched the show, the struggles, the difficulties, the services that you ladies go through and provide your country is commendable. Just just unbelievable having one of you sitting here with a familiar belly that we were just talking about, you know. So I think hats off. This is something that it really epitomized certain things that I couldn't read and glean from a book. So it was eye-opening. The reality is that, and my job here is to ask more questions. I will not have any brilliant, earth-shattering answers for you. But when you look at the country in general, the show stole my thunder. It was beautiful in the last 15 minutes because all through I'm thinking, they're not going to go there. They're not going to go there. The country's not ready for that conversation. Because if you look at the show, it almost starts, if you go from that camera, it starts with a close-up of one person. It starts with the story of one fighter pilot. And then it kind of zooms out, goes to a wider angle where Eric jumps in and then Sam comes in. So there is now there is a family. And I'm thinking that's where the camera is going to stop. It's not going to go further wide because, like you said, after ABC, there is a D, E, and F. So there is perspective. There are layers of perspective. And the show so beautifully then, I believe, wrestled with that most difficult layer of the perspective, which is ultimately, these are huge sacrifices that you're making. They have to serve a purpose. Are they serving the purpose? So that's the wider question that ultimately every sacrifice, you guys are giving up your, you know, your careers and you're choosing these heroic careers because there is a purpose behind that. So I think the last 15 minutes then go to discuss that. Are we achieving that purpose? And it's not that much of a PTSD because I think she uses, there's a line in there where she says, when she's court-martialed, and she says, it takes guts, guts like you will never understand. You know, she looks at the crowd and she says, guts like you'll never understand. And don't think you are safe because one day it'll be your turn. Now, those are some very deeper questions because it starts with gender, goes to family, and then goes to the wider angle of humanity, which is all life equal? Because to me, from an ethicist standpoint or a medical standpoint, you know, my day job is a medical doctor, and then, yes, I serve as an ethicist. But, you know, we see patients of all colors, races, gender. When you open them up, the gallbladder looks just the same. You can't really tell a gallbladder and then link it back to a black, white, Latino, Muslim, Jewish. None of that happens. So I think that was the beautiful question, and I'll just stop after that. But because why I believed, why I was surprised, I was absolutely not expecting. Whoever wrote the show, they just, you know, that was bullseye. They got me there. Because if you look at the country, it does not support. Gallup did a survey last year asking Americans how many of us would support drone strikes. Any idea what percentage of people, Americans? Just give me a quick number. Somewhere in between. It's 65. So 2 out of 3. They support drone strikes in Pakistan or Yemen. But it's fascinating the next question they asked, or another question they asked. They said, so the first question was, if there is a terrorist hiding, how many of you would support? The second question says, what if that terrorist is hiding in U.S.? Right? And the number drops to 15%. From 65 to 15, what's the difference? In fact, I'm more scared of a terrorist who's hiding in Baltimore as compared to Yemen, right? He's a more immediate danger. So that is what struck me, that as a country, we haven't wrestled with that question, which I believe the play wrestled so beautifully in the end.
Let me go to Marin.
In the last 15 minutes, what struck me was it wasn't the fact that she was a mother that she was disintegrating. I could have seen a father having the same reaction. So that stopped me in my tracks right there. And I also don't think I think she was waiting for her court-martial, but I don't even know if the military would have gone there with the mental issues that I saw in the play. But what I started to think about was it's been 12, 13 years since 911, and right after it happened, within a week, Heather was up flying, doing her thing, and an order came down for an intel officer, which is what I am by trade, to go away, away. We don't know where at the time. And I was the one person that had to go because I had no kids and no husband, and I could lead the fastest. And I ended up going down to Central Command, CENTCOM, down in Florida. So I felt like I was in Saudi Arabia because I was inside in the dark for 12 hours and didn't know where I was. And back in just 12 years ago, I was physically putting little red triangles on little pictures. And now we're talking about drones. And even when I was doing that, you don't think there's a husband and a wife in that house where you're putting this stuff. And I think when you're looking at that gray screen, you don't think about that either, you know, until she brought that child up. And I think Heather mentioned this too, that if there's children and families, we don't just drop stuff. I mean, we have high criteria for that. But, yeah, that took me to a lot of places the last 15 minutes.
Alex, you saw the last 15 minutes.
I did. So I've had flying deployments. I've had deployments where I'm looking through the FLIR or the radar or binoculars on the ground. And then I've had a boots on ground deployment where I'm actually there. I was in Afghanistan for a year. It's much different being on the ground, for sure. Just the smells alone are much more intense. You get to know the people, right? So when you're on the ground, you have linguists. You have, in my case, it was Afghan nationals who came and worked for the Americans. And so, you know, we'd go through a village and you'd say, oh, my cousin lives here, or let me go stop in and see some family. And so it is much more real when you're on the ground. But when you're in the air, I didn't go through the stress. I didn't go through the sort of PTSD cycle in the air. And I think it is because we train so long and so well that when you're there, hopefully, you know, you should be train like you fight like you train, and it shouldn't be that stressful or that traumatic for you. The 12-hour shifts kind of got me. I've certainly the flights are long, but we have crew rest, and we have docs embedded with us. We have chaplains and other resources available to us, and then we look out for each other so that if there is some sort of operational stress issue, it should be flagged. We have a lot of systems in place to, you know, help people who are deployed, who are operational, and hopefully intervene before there's a breakdown, definitely a breakdown in the cockpit or at a console like that. So, again, it's a play. They got to cram it all in 75 minutes. But I personally, I didn't go through that.
So I'd like to speak up here a little bit, Mark. I want to avoid the perception that war from the air is less moral than war on the ground, simply because if it's war on the ground, then you get to know people and you have personal relationships. Let me just be frank. All war is tragic, horrid, and very personal for the people who are involved in it. One of the deployments that I was, my second deployment to Iraq, I watched insurgents drag a family out of a house, bind them, and set them all on fire. So simply because you're in the air doesn't necessarily mean that you're not exposed to the horrors of war. One of the things that I noticed as I read through the script is that because of the way that we execute the RPA work cycle, if you will, so the remotely piloted aircraft, the in this case the character, and in fact, many Air Force pilots and their systems operators are out in Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and they go home when they're done with their shift, and they go home to their families. And what they've done has been highly classified. They can't talk about what they did at work with their family. And because it's not a deployed environment, they're not spending time with their brothers and sisters to process through what they've been through. So on the deployments that I've been in, there's always some portion of the squadron building where people just kind of hang out. And when you're done doing your debrief over your mission, you grab a cup of coffee and you sit down and you start talking about whether or not that's what's going on at home or what happened on your mission. And there's an opportunity to be able to process through your experience with others who have had a similar or same experience. And that's not available to our operators who do remotely piloted aircraft missions or their weapon system. They have to go home. And so they're isolated. They are deprived of many of the support mechanisms and coping mechanisms that are built into wartime operations when they're deployed locations. And plus, they have to worry about, you know, getting the oil changed on the car and running to the grocery store and making sure that the plumber shows up. When you go into a deployed location, the only thing you care about is war. That's the only thing that's on your mind. So it allows you the opportunity to compartmentalize what's going on. And so I think that's an important element that drives the character in the drama and contributes to the unraveling of her psyche, because there is no opportunity to compartmentalize. There is no opportunity to, I mean, for example, the little trash heap that she builds, I mean, that's a coping mechanism that she's forced to do because she's alone in making this happen. So in trying to cope with what she's doing.
That's an excellent point. Excellent point. I think, can I just make a quick comment? Because you used that keyword, compartmentalize. Because my second question was, and I completely agree, we go through, this is, you know, chess 500 times, through all those calculations. But somewhere, somehow, someone has to deal with the end result, which cannot be compartmentalized. To take you back to the gallbladder, we take a lot of precautions before surgery. If you ever go to an operating room, there's a checklist of things that we, and you know, we borrow it from the airline industry, by the way. We talk about the airline industry all the time. There's a checklist before you go under.
Which, by the way, the B-17 actually invented, was invented by the Army Air Corps.
It's a fantastic tool. Fantastic tool. So, you know, there's a timeout, there's a checklist, there's a long list of processes that have to be in place. But guess what? God forbid you have a bad outcome. None of that matters in the court of law. That's not defense, that I did these things. Because in the end, at the end of the day, we did not meet standard of care. You had a bad outcome. So the question I have is, if you look at the data of just drone strikes in Pakistan, nearly 2,300 people have died since 2008. 2,300 people. Out of that, approximately 300 were deemed militants. Deemed. There is no way to be sure. 2,000 of them are unaccounted for potential innocent civilians. If I practice that way, and I'm not, you know, of course, and I'm just, you know, I have to draw that parallel. If I practice that way, my license will be gone in a day. And I have huge admiration for your job, because I think when she's given that joystick, it's impossible to expect her not to fire. She's, at that moment, she has to compartmentalize, follow the order. But somewhere, somehow, someone has to answer the question that, is this the purpose? And is it, you know, is this the purpose for which we're giving up our lives? Is this the purpose for which a mother is going through so much pain and suffering? And if that is the purpose, is this how we achieve that purpose? That, and one of the military commanders, I'm forgetting the name, I can share that with you later, he wrote in New York Times that for every high caliber target, there are 50 civilians who perish. 1 to 50. Is this the purpose? So that is someone has to answer that question.
So let me ask a question, that, because it's a great number, you know. Oh my goodness, since 2008, nearly 2,000 innocents. Yeah, 2,000 innocents, so the 300 militants. But the number that's always missing to me is, how many innocents are killed by the militants and insurgents? So we make this comparison, my goodness, how terrible it is that we have this type of collateral damage, that we're not able to make our weapons more precise, which, by the way, we have come just magnitudes of advancement in decreasing the level of force necessary to target these high-value assets. And actually, even just in the prosecution of war, the United States has absolutely led the way since World War II in really minimizing the necessary use of force in order to be able to achieve our objectives. But in this number of 300 bad guys, 2,000 innocents, how many people, innocents, die in the market space, in the marketplaces, because of insurgent bombs? How many innocents die, and I'm not talking about Americans, I'm talking about nationals,
as a result of IEDs. So I'm concerned that the frame of reference that you're using, sir, inappropriately excludes the deaths that are caused by the insurgents and by the militants and by these jihadist groups that they're imposing on their own people.
See, excellent point. Can I just quickly answer?
So purpose matters.
Very quick answer, I think, from an ethical standpoint, again, would be I could say horrible things about my mother, but if you said it, that would be problematic. See, that's
so
the
it's
answer.
Okay for them to kill each other?
I'm telling you, I'm telling you, deep down, that's the answer, whether we like it or not, because this happens all the time. You just flip the question. You could say something about your mom that I can't. That's the whole answer. But anyway,
let me push the tad further. How many people who would like to have a comment in the audience? If you have a question, raise your hand. I'll come to you in a second. I'll come over and get you all to be part of this. So this is in some ways. I didn't know we were going to go here today, but we're here. So let's talk about this for a minute. I mean, I think that when you're in a war, I was thinking about Vietnam, and Hugh Thompson's a guy I knew very well. I don't know how many people know who Hugh Thompson was. Hugh Thompson was the helicopter pilot who stopped My Lai, the My Lai massacre. When he turned his helicopter on and trained it on his own fellow troops, saying, you can't do this anymore. This is over. I'm not letting you do this. Now, that is one thing. The other thing, though, is that when you're in the midst of war, the only thing that you think about is survival and the person next to you surviving and getting out. That's also the reality. So there are two different sets of ethics here that happen to people. And I think that's part of it. The other part, I think, what's happening in America now is that there are people who question the efficacy and the ethics of using drones in this way, in these wars, because of what Fahim said, and I think that's not something that I think sometimes people who are in the middle of war can have the luxury of debating.
Well, I'd like to just interject again.
Go ahead, Alex.
We have an extensive curriculum of leadership ethics and morality. We have ethicists on the staff of the United States Naval Academy. I'm sure the Air Force Academy has the same rigorous curriculum. So to dismiss it as saying we're just going to throw these young men and women out on the battlefield and let them sort of have this carnal reaction, that's not the reality.
Morality matters more in war.
And we spend a lot of money, we spend a lot of time and effort to train the young men and women before they go out there so that they can have this critical thinking process and that they can rely on these ethics and morals. And we take an oath, right, when we commission, and it's very specific. So, you know, I want to sort of push back on this idea that people are making a decision whether or not to pull the trigger on a whim or sort of from a primal space.
But that's exactly what I was not saying. As I said, I clearly demarcate people who are in the thick of the war. I would not expect, even though there are processes and you're being taught, completely agreed, that's absolutely not where my question is pointed. If I were there, or if my sister were there, I would want her to do exactly what you are doing. Exactly what every one of them is doing, because that at that moment, that is expected. But the point of, that's why I'm saying, you can make heaps and mountains of process. Somebody has to answer the question of the outcome. I'm trying to figure out who is that someone. I think that is my question. I have no question about the process.
And I'll say a little bit something there. I mean, that is a level of national policy, right? So that's why we need to be engaged voters within our republic and actually vote for who is going to represent us in Congress and who is going to be within the White House, because those are decisions that are made at the administration
Agreed.
Level,
yep.
right?
Agreed. Yep.
Regarding, you know, I can say bad things about my mother, but you can't say bad things about my mother. That also brings up a very interesting point regarding the morality of war from a national security standpoint, because I think after the Holocaust occurred in World War II, we thought to ourselves, as a nation, perhaps as a globe, that never again could we allow people to be persecuted to that type of level. And so there's, I think, also a tremendous amount of pressure from the ethical standpoint to intervene in humanitarian situations, whether or not that's levels of genocide or operations other than war, for our nation to intervene when those things occur. And so I wonder to what extent, I'd be curious about your thoughts, given that that's their mess, they need to figure that out no matter how much bloodshed occurs. At what point does it become the global leader's responsibility to intervene in humanitarian crises?
Excellent question. I think the larger question linked to that is, how do you select where to intervene ethically? Why not intervene in Darfur? Are those lives not equal when there are a million people? Why not intervene in Angola? There is a saying in Iraq, there is a saying in Middle East, that we'd be living happily if we had potatoes instead of oil. Because potatoes don't get you killed. When you're sitting on the energy supply of the world, these are the larger ethical questions. You're absolutely right. We should never allow another Holocaust. But how do we pick and choose? You know, there are people dying all over the world. We pick and choose a certain mess, and we ignore 20 other messes, and who is going to answer that?
So again, I just want to make the delineation for the audience that it's not the pilot or the drone operator who's picking and choosing.
Completely
those
agreed.
Decisions are made at the national security level, right. The foreign policy level.
You know what? I have to now stand up and do this. This
yeah.
is my
Our
group.
Rules
Don't bother these people.
The rules of engagement are set much
I'm
higher.
I'm so much on your side, colonels and you know commanders. You have no idea. I have huge respect for what you're doing.
Let me go into the audience here while we have time. But go here, and then over here, then over there, okay? Right here.
Okay. Actually, I don't have a question. I just think the difficult thing about making war against terrorists is they play by a different set of rules than we do. So we care about collateral damage. We don't want to kill innocent people. If you talk to a terrorist about collateral damage, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. They want to maximize collateral damage, and the more random it is, the better. They want to kill innocents because then people worry about, well, it could be me because of those people. They're not guilty. So we're trying to make war against people and get bad guys who know we care about collateral damage. And so they hide among innocent people to make it more difficult for us to get to them. So my hat's off to people that are trying to make war against terrorists. It's just a massively difficult thing to do.
I'd like to respond to that really quickly.
Let me say this first before you do. That we're actually running over time. So I'm going to ask if you have responses that we make kind of pithy responses so we can close this hour out. And I would just start off with this. I agree with what you're saying, though that's an excuse we used in Vietnam too. They killed over a million Vietnamese who had nothing to do with the war. So that can go a number of ways. So
my pithy response is...
Let's go around. I was going to start here.
I'll just give one-liner. Our numbers don't support our rationale. If you look at the number of people that we've killed in war just over the past 10 years, there is no way to support the argument that we are waging any compassionate war.
Heather, let's go down the line.
Well, no war is compassionate. But I will say that because we are able to use RPAs or drones in order to be able to track these human targets, we're actually able to be far more precise regarding knowing who's really a bad guy and being able to minimize the level of force. If we did not have persistent intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, we would not even know where these people are, and I think we would be in a much more tragic situation.
So let me thank the folks here. Lieutenant Commander Alex Dietrich, before that Colonel Marin McAvoy, Major Heather Penny, and Dr. Vahim Yunus. Thank you all so much for being part of the world of the play here at Everyman Theater.
You just heard Lieutenant Commander Alex Dietrich, an F-A-18F strike fighter pilot from the VFA-41 Black Aces of Lynmore, California. Colonel Marin McAvoy, the Vice Commander of the 113th Wing
in the District of Columbia Air National Guard. Major Heather Penny, formerly of the 121st Fighter Squadron, who now flies with the Air National Guard. And Dr. Fahim Yunus, Senior Fellow at the Hofburger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore and a Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Maryland. In conversation around Everyman Theater's current performance of Grounded. For more information on our guests and Grounded, visit everymantheater.org. And send us your feedback on today's shows at talk@steinershow.org. On our way out of here, we're hearing Shoplifters of the World Unite by the Smiths. Johnny Marr of the Smiths, born on this day in 1963. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.